Jema, so let us continue the tales from the Bhagavat, stories from the Bhagavat with a little bit of background. So we have, last time we are reading about, we were sharing about the importance of the Bhagavat Puran. And these are, there are a couple of stories which we may like to go through before we enter into the book itself. So one of the story is about... you know, when Sri Krishna is departing, then his dearest friend Uddhav, he comes to him and says, well, you have been here, so dharma has been maintained. Because you are here, people were impelled to do righteous things. What happens when you are away? So he cannot bear that separation. He says, you take me along with you. So Sri Krishna says, but my purpose is over and I have to go back. So he says, but you have to do something. I can't live without you. Now this is a very interesting significance with regard to Sri Aurobindo and the mother. So Sri Krishna concentrates for a while, gives his one of his most beautiful, bewitching smiles. And then he says, okay, I'll pour myself in this Bhagavat. And as the story goes, he dissolves into Bhagavat. That when I am not here, this will be the rasa which will sustain. Because see, when you ultimately, what sustains this creation? If you go to the Gita, it describes the cosmic tree, the tree of cosmic manifestation, the Ashwat tree, which has roots above and spreads below. But at the end, after describing the cosmic tree, that you know what is the trunk and the Vedas and all the Upanishads and the Upavedas and all these, he describes Sri Krishna. At the end he says the sap of this tree is Soma, or that is Ananda. He is the sap of the tree. So essentially if you get that sap, all the rest of the things are taken care of. Because so Bhagavat is the sap of the Vedas and the Upanishads, not the milk. Just imagine the sap which is nourishing. All of this has come out of that Ananda. And why he said it has relevance to Sri Aurobindo and the mother, that they have poured themselves into, of course, their countless works, and most of all Savitri. And I must add, it's a pity that while, you know, people come, go, live, but they don't read Sri Aurobindo and the mother, and they don't engage with Savitri. If only they engage with Savitri, they will never ever again miss this. I can say for sure, because as Sri Krishna puts in the Bhagavat, he says, I am within you. So always we'll see that when the question starts about who, tell us, the sages will gather and they will ask a question. So all of them gather in Naimisharanya. Now we make a proper entry into the Bhagavat. And look at that, you know, these sages are wondering what is the solution to the problem of mankind. So they say that Kali Yuga has come after the Lord has left and all kinds of things are happening. So what is the solution? So they are contemplating on this. It's like a round table conference in Naimisharanya. We already spoke about what Naimisharanya is, and you know, these sages come. And prominent among those sages, one of them is of course Shaunak. Now it's very interesting, his name comes from his father. Sunak, must have now heard, you know, the name clicks. Sunak. So Sunak is a sage. And it's interesting that the children were named in some way or the other after their father or mother in this way. So Shaunak becomes the Sunak. Similarly, we have Partha, who is Arjun, because he is son of his mother, is, you know, who is the daughter of Prithu. So this is a tradition which, interestingly, in the southern parts of India, you still find. You'll find that after the names, there is the name of the father or the mother. In ancient time, like Satyakam, Jabali. Jabali is the mother. So basically, it is that lineage, to say that this lineage I am coming from, and all this is there. Then there is another rishi who is narrating to everybody, and he is Sutji. Now, one must be wondering who is Sutji. So leaving aside the name and other things, he is the son of a sage called Romaharshan or Lomaharshan. But the interesting part is he comes from a family of the charioteers, those who drive the chariot. So Sut. So you must have heard, see, it's very interesting. In Mahabharata, you have another Sut who is Karna. but is always bitter. And here there is another Sooth. He is called as Sooth because he belongs to the family of those who were driving the chariots. But here is a man revered for his wisdom. Even the sages come to him. So all this idea that we have today of, you know, India, caste, all this is absolutely false narrative. So he is a Sooth, but he is one of the most revered and venerated sages who will recount the Bhagavad. So they are contemplating. Now imagine if today we contemplate, a lot of people sit together and say, oh, life is miserable, this is there, what is to be done? So some discuss about AI, some discuss about this or that. What do they contemplate? They contemplate that if the Lord is not physically on earth, life is going to be difficult. And this is spoken about, particularly about India, that there is never a time when someone or the other who becomes the upholder of the divine energy is upon earth. Always. It is known because these are the people who are the silent, silently they are moving the earth. So much so that Sri Krishna says in the Gita, if I don't act, these worlds will go into perdition. So the presence of people who are spiritually oriented, higher in consciousness, is so important. Something to which the world is absolutely right, even till date. What are you doing? Now you can't tell them we are trying to become hubs of spiritual consciousness. That will be abracadabra. But well, if somebody, a scientist says, well, I am going to discover a new form of energy, it will be as abracadabra. So that's not important. But they are discussing that how can man's consciousness be uplifted. So they realize that this is because there is a crisis of consciousness. And as we read in the previous story, that there is bhakti, there is dharma, there is vairagya and jnana, all of them are dying. So they need to be revived. So their solution is very different. Their solution is not outer advancement, which may be there, may not be there, means that's okay, that's an aside. But the real thing is that man's consciousness may be elevated, so they are concerned about it, and they meet together, have a meeting, that how can man's consciousness be uplifted? So they discuss of all the means. So they say, well, we have been engaged in 1,000 years of tapasya. Now this obviously lineage. He says that it's so difficult. Then they say that, well, if we follow the nirguni path, it's not easy. So nothing is tapasya, it's so difficult. So they are sitting together, what is the easy way for man's consciousness to be uplifted? And then this comes as a solution, that the divine's glories, the divine names, hearing them, Shravana, that itself is liberating. So people may think that it's a superstition. No, there is a very beautiful scientific thing about it. And I have spoken about it earlier also. How does the mantra work? Because if you go back to the origin of Srishti, it is by Nada, there is sound. So mantras are various sound vibrations which will take you to one level, another level, etc., etc. of consciousness, because they are in sync with that level. That's the origin of the mantra. They are the highest intensities of human speech. Now when the divine comes and assumes a name, now where are the mantras leading you? It's like, where are the Vedas leading you? They're leading you to that divine being, supreme. Now when the supreme himself comes to you, then that name itself becomes a power for the earth. It gets imprinted in the earth consciousness. And I can assure that anybody who, even for a while, simply Mother Sri Aurobindo, Mother Sri Aurobindo, Sri Aurobindo, Sri Aurobindo, Sri Aurobindo, just a few minutes, it's such a delightful thing. You may do mantra sadhana, it's perfectly fine. But this is like an instant, that name has a power, and Mother speaks about it. There is a letter of Sri Aurobindo, Naam Jap has a great power in it. At one place he even says, there is no method in this yoga except to take the mother's name, and there is no mantra in this yoga except to take the mother's name and mine. So that is the power of the name. It is not a superstition. It is, and if I have to understand it neurologically. So it's very interesting that when you take the name, so what is happening is, as Savitri uses the word, name is the foundation of eternity. And it resounds. So where does it resound? It goes through the cochlear nerve, it goes into the brain, it starts stirring. Now, it is literally like resetting all your rhythms by the power of that sound, that one name, one sound which contains in itself the seed of the future. That's Sri Aurobindo and the mother's name. And it would apply to Krishna name, you know, Sri Krishna's name. So that name has a power which starts setting, resetting everything. It's like, very simply, if I say that, you know, there's a big traffic problem, all this is going on. And suddenly, you know, if you have to clear all that, you need to say, hurry, hurry, you know, he's coming. Who is coming? The king is coming. Now you, nobody is able to see the king. The king is coming. The king is coming. Now you see, slowly people start adjusting and they are quiet. King is coming. Maybe he'll come this side or that side and everybody is waiting for the king. So something like this happens when we take the name of the God. Another thing is that when we take the name of God and hear his stories, so what happens is we are coming in contact with the image of the Lord. It's like in some way our mind is throwing images. And that's why sometimes it's not very good, though television has done service and films do their own service. But it's much better if you have your own image. Because when you see them on the screen, then an image is formed which is ready-made. Ready-made images have their own problem. They help and they condition both ways. But when your mind forms an image, when you read, of course, we are fortunate that Mother and Sri Aurobindo gave actual photograph. So it contains their energy and it radiates from there. But otherwise, when you pick up an image which is there in the already the standard image, it's not yet your own image. Otherwise, when you read about Krishna, your mind forms its own image. So this way, the mind comes into contact with the divine personality of the Lord. And therefore, when you come in contact with him, when you read stories about, you know, the kind of things that people related with him, then you fall in love. You know, there is a story of somebody who was sitting in the train and he was hearing stories about the mother. And at the end, he said, you know, I have heard so much about mother from you people. I wish I could go, but I cannot go because I have to get down here. Please carry this 1 rupee and give it to your mother. He never seen the mother. And when the person goes and gives it to the mother, mother held it in the hand for a long time. She went into trance. And then she says the divine will find it difficult to repay him. He has only heard. So Shravana. That's how the Rishi start. That, you know, we want to do Shravana of that katha. That story. Tell us about, then they ask the questions. So there is the first chapter is about the questions asked by the rishis. So the question is very specific. So they want to know, tell us about that supreme who incarnated as Vasudeva. Now, or Vasudeva. Now, it's very interesting that they are using the word Vasudeva. And that's why when mother was asked about the Bhagavad Puran, she says Krishna is the immanent divine. So who is Vasudeva? Vasudeva is the divine who dwells within creation. So we'll have another word called Narayana. So while divine has many, many things, but he's the closest to us. He is seated in the heart. He says, tell us about Vasudeva and who incarnated. And then they ask, tell us all about his exploits, his Leela. Which means give us his secret. His ways of working. Because Leela is about that. Then he says, tell us about his incarnations. And tell us what happened. So when they ask all about the Lord and his Leela, and then the narrative starts very beautifully. One of them is that tell us about that supreme being. Now, very interestingly, it says the supreme being with 16 members or 16 parts. So you'll hear about Krishna that he is a Poonavatar because he has 16 Kalas. Now, when you read the list of Kalas on Baba Google, it will list randomly all the qualities. But that's not what it means. Because that doesn't convey the point. That takes you to Sagun Brahma. But this is something different. And the Bhagavat helps us. It says, I'll tell you about the being with 16 members. This is a question also in Prashnupanishad. In Prashnupanishad, some of the rishis come to Rishi Pipalad. And they have certain questions. So one of them says, you know, sire, a sage or a king came to me and asked me, tell me about the being with 16 members. And I said, well, I really don't know. I don't want to tell you something false. And so he went away. He says, since then I am curious to know about the being with 16 members. Now, on one level, it's very simple. If you go into the Sankhya philosophy, and it Bhagavad describes that. So 15 is 5 karma indriyas, the organs of knowledge, 5 jnana indriyas, the five Gyanendriya, organs of knowledge, and five Karmendriya, the organs of action, five Panch Mahabhut, and one mind. You say, what's the big deal about it? Because Sankhya also talks about 24 elements. No, there is a very interesting thing. If you go to the Sankhya, Sankhya creates a divide between nature and the self, the Purusha. But here in the beginning itself, he says that it is he who brings them out of himself. So all of these different, senses, these organs of action, all of them are brought out of the Lord Vasudeva from himself. That means there is a gross action of these senses and the mind, and there is a subtle action of the senses and the mind. You see how the Ken Upanishad puts it differently. It says that, yan man sana manute yena hur manomatang. Or it says that which the eyes cannot see, but that which the eyes is seen. So there is a double counterpart. There is the outer, where we have five senses, five organs of action, and we have the five elemental energies, and we have the mind, which controls them. Now, corresponding to them, let's say there are divine senses, and Shobindra speaks about it. There are poems of divine sense. There is a divine action which takes place, which doesn't require necessarily these outer things, like how Shobindra was, or Shri Krishna sitting on the battlefield is continuing the action. And there are the five subtle states of all these gross elements, which have emerged from the divine. They are five forms of powers or energy which operate in the world, and there is a divine mind which holds them all together, and above them there is the divine intelligence, and there is the being called, whom we know as Krishna. So it means, and it fills a hiatus of understanding. For example, we are told that all this, your actions, senses, all this you have to get rid of, or you have to come out of these objects. That's how we are told normally, ordinarily in the yoga. So it disconnects the human personality from the divine, who is Brahman. And he has no business to do with it. There is Maya, which somehow comes, steps in, and creates this world of illusions. And you have to cut off. It raises a big question. Question is then, does my personality and its members have any reality at all? What is the origin of human personality? One could write a whole book of psychology on this. So there is the origin of our human personality. There is a heart behind the heart. There is a mind behind the mind. There is an intelligence behind the intelligence. There is a sense behind the sense. There is a life behind the life. And we see this in Mother's Prayer. Life of our life, the intelligence of our intelligence. So basically, they come from the Supreme Lord. So you see, there is a secret of transformation here. If they come from the divine, and that's how the Bhagavad just hints and then leaves us at that. He says, it is he who becomes the Trigunatmak Prakriti. It says very interestingly. And he enters into it, but he remains free. So it's very... And of course, Shobindra describes it at great length in Essays on the Gita. So those who read the Essays on the Gita, they'll find very interesting combination of the Gita and the Bhagavad. So there Sri Aurobindo explains very beautifully. He says that, well, how do you rise above the gunas and yet continue to work? So he says, as the Lord works, he's above the gunas and works. So the question arises, does he not get bound? So Bhagavat answered that, no, he is not bound. So then he takes us to that point that, well, there is a pure action. The gunas are inferior modes which human beings use, our operating system of nature. And there is a pure action of all of them. And the Bhagavat describes them as Brahma, Vishnu, Mahesh, the godheads behind the gunas. So if you go to the Indian thought, you will see that, well, Shiva is Tamogun. He is the Lord of Tamogun. Brahma is the Lord of Rajogun. And Vishnu is the Lord of Sattugun. So, invariably from that, the logic comes that if you nurture Sattugun inside you, then you become a candidate for the next level, which is entering into the Supreme Being. So, this is the whole story which goes. And So there is an origin of these gunas which is in the Lord. He enters into the lower creation and out of that the gunas come. And where is it described? Just imagine Savitri, triple soul forces. You have a pure action of the gunas. So what is the pure action of the guna? Tamogun. So the Lord rests in the eternal waters. Is he asleep? Yes, he is asleep. Is he in a state of lethargy? No. He is in a state of deep peace and calm. So this calm remains even in the midst of action. Is the Lord operating in the world? Well, out of him emerges the lotus and Brahma, and out of him creation emerges. Rajogun comes out of that. But here creation, kinesis is a state of ananda. And why do we experience joy and sorrow? Because we don't act as the Lord acts in freedom. We act by the ego, bound by the ego. And there is another story in Bhagavad which connects with that. So there is the ego. When we enter into the ego, then action becomes a bondage, because invariably it afflicts us with pleasure and pain, insult and praise. So all these things come. And okay, let me say as an aside, so when you come to the ashram, be ready to take both less of praise, more of insult. So you can be prepared, because it's a lower action. So the divine is liberating into a pure action. And Sri Krishna's life is an example. How many people insulted him? And yet, you know, he continued to do what he did. And because that's how is a pure divine action, full of ananda. Satgun has a divine corresponding light and joy, which is not like our light and joy is very troubled and precarious, because we are always worried about doing the right thing, according to norms, according to Shastra, according to this, according to that. So very precarious. And even when you have done, you know you're not really always invariably in Sukham or Prakasham. It's the only light. But the divine acts under the rule of a spontaneous right and light. It's not even a rule, because you can't bind him to any rule. So this, in this small little nutshell, it is described, the Supreme Being. And it is described very well that when time comes, he absorbs all these gunas and all the world which has come and the five Mahabhuts back into him, then it is pure being. So divine is not just an impersonal, he is impersonal also, but he is an impersonal personality. And you know where it comes? It comes much later in the life divine, in the Gnostic being. What does Sri Aurobindo describe? He says, like in the Gita, he will be an impersonal personality, which is what A.B. Purani understood about him. Meaning thereby, he is not acting according to any fixed format of the lower nature. And yet, he is a personality, but you can't fix that personality. He is this or he is that, because he is infinite. So he says, Gnostic beings will embody that. But the original embodiment is the Lord. So, and he is the one, also the origin of all the avatars. So why does it stop at Kalki avatar? This used to be at least my question. Why does it stop after Kalki? Because after that, this original format of the divine personality in his original splendor and the lower nature, where you are the under the influence of the lower Maya or the Avidyamay Maya, that goes completely. So there will be a mini Krishna or a divine personality in everyone. That's what a Gnostic being is. You want to understand the Gnostic being? This is the simplest way. So all this at one, you know, it's a package, as I said, and a very power-packed package. So then he describes the Supreme Being. Sutji describes that. Now I'll tell you about, before I tell you about the Leela, they say, tell us about his incarnations. So we have the standard list of incarnations, which are about 10. That is Vishnu, you will see it in the Vishnu Puran. But when you talk about the Bhagavat Puran, then the list is 18. And there is a reason for it. And the first of the, because it is covering, even before, you know, it speaks of Brahma, Vishnu, Mahesh coming as the origin, beginning, the three gunas. From there the Triguni Maya comes. Lord enters into it, enters into every creature. Now imagine how profound this truth is, that divine is everywhere in everything, in every element of creation. Everything is sacred. Everything is to be respected. If we go into its essence, it's so amazing. There is nothing where he is not pervading. That's how the Bhagavad introduces, like a big bang. Our hero is everywhere. He is in everything. Now just imagine, just contemplating on that is so liberating. So then it starts, okay. First what he does, he puts him in the waters. That is the origin of all avatars. And Mother speaks of the same thing, the origin of all avatars whom she see lying in the waters. It's exactly like it is in the Bhagavad. I mean, some, actually the description that way, but he's lying in the water and she sees there is the origin of all the avatars, and she doesn't mention how many avatars. And each of these avatars, basically, his waters are the cosmic waters. And he's lying below it. His eyes are closed. Mother described this story very interestingly. She says, I went and saw the origin of all avatars. And as she went there, his eyes opened. Meaning thereby, now a new possibility is going to emerge. He says, tell us about the incarnations of the Lord. So who is the first avatar? Speaks about the Shukara avatar or the Varaha. The literal word used is Shukara. But if you go into the Varaha, it's very interesting. Even the Shukara, basically what is Shukara doing? He is, if you take either meaning, one is that it is the pig. Now what is the pig doing? It is rolling in the mud and it's taking away, cleansing in a way, all the dirt, all the mud, it's cleansing. And therefore, it is able to bring the earth out of the waters. So what does Varaha mean? Literally it means, it's one is meaning is again the pig or the wild boar to be more specific. But its other meaning is simply that which lifts out. So Varaha avatar is the first one because the now grand scene has to start. Lord has to start playing. So earth becomes a special formation. Earth is a special formation. Mother speaks about it. It's not formed in just the normal way. So earth comes out because the Varaha avatar lifts it out. It rolls into its whatever is the subconscious mud and mire, takes it into himself, kills Hiranyaksha. That's another story. We'll talk about it when we talk about the avatars of Vishnu. The two original Daityas are Hiranyaksha and Hiranyakashyapu. And they are born of Diti. Diti and Aditi are two wives of Rishi Kashyap, both. And Diti means division. So, Daityas. And Aditi means Aditi. That which is undivided. You see, today we can see Diti and Aditi. You can see the Daityas. Daityas are those that divide. Adityas are those which join. So this division can go to that extent that, you know, world is and only God is there. It can go to that extent. So there is the Diti who are children of the Daityas. The original are these two, Hiranyaksha and Hiranyakashyapu. And they put back, they exercise a pull. They want to put the earth back. So they are the original forces of the inconscient which pull it back. And Varaha avatar lifts it out. So that's the first avatar of the Lord. And then comes, there is one more avatar, and then comes Narad Muni. So Narad Muni is the mediator who mediates between earth and the higher worlds. And then comes, I have noted the list because they are quite a considerable thing. I remember, but the sequence will be interesting. So just to, first is Sanakadik. Then there is the Varaha. Sanakadik don't enter into creation. We have spoken about them. They are the four Kumaras. They say, we are not interested. As simple as that. They remain forever pure. But you cannot have, why they are afraid? So see the logical sequence. They don't want to enter into creation because there is no meaning thereby. If I enter into it, a lot of mud will come into me. So, if you enter into yoga of transformation, you can't remain Mr. Clean. Lot of things will come which you, and that's part of the work, you just can't help it. So there is always a tendency like Sankadik, that is the marg of Vairagya, stay away. So they are the first avatars. They come out of Brahma. But then comes the Vara. He says, I will absorb the mud. Let's start. So he takes upon himself the burden of earth nature. And that's, Yobindo says that in God's labor, he who would bring the heavens here must himself descend into clay. See, this is Vara avatar story. And the burden of earthly nature bear and tread the dolorous way. Vara avatar literally descends into the mud of earth nature. Rolls in it. Because that's how life and creation could be. So unlike Sankadik, the four Kumaras who turned away, he enters into the mud and he lifts out. Then comes Narad Muni. Narad Muni, what does he establish? He establishes the possibility of man becoming God-like in status. So Narad Muni is reveals God to fall upon earth. But Narad Muni story, we'll come to that because it's a very fascinating story. It's a very lovely story. One of the most lovely stories, very unlike what is normally portrayed, that Narad Muni is just going here and there. And it's, I would say, a shame and a pity. Shame that Indians narrate the story like that, Narad Muni, they will use casually. And Sri Aurobindo has immortalized him in Savitri. And yet, there are many, I know, Indians, Hindus, who will talk about Narad Muni as somebody who is simply doing, chugli from here and there. Yeah, simply. But that's not Narad Muni is catalyzing. He is bringing together. And he is the one who first established the possibility of a human becoming a demigod. So he is one of the demigods who do a back and forth. They are like messengers. What was it we were talking about? Courier service. Courier service between God and man. So he carries the messages. Like he's like that. And then comes, which story we can read today, share a little bit more today, is the Nar Narayan. So Sri Aurobindo speaks about Nar Narayan in number of places. In Record of Yoga, he speaks about actually having had both the realization first of Nar, then of Narayan and of Nar Narayan. So Nar Narayan's story is that, well, Dharma, some people again interpret Dharma as Yama. It's very sad, you know, even in the standard websites you'll see. Yama is the restrainer. Dharma is the liberator. But how? If you lead a life, Dharma is about living by the right law. It's not meant to just restrain blindly. So there is a difference. If you put a set of moral rules of do's and don'ts, you are not Dharma. You are a child of Yama. But if you understand what Dharma is, its deep essence, and that's what we'll see in the story, then it liberates you. So there is Dharma. Dharma, who marries, the name of the goddess is Murti. Now again, people don't get it, like why Murti? So they say Ahinsa. You will see a it's not translation. They just jabardasti marriage kara diya. Dharma Ahinsa Chevacho. So they say no. Actually, the name of the wife is Ahinsa, but it's not Ahinsa. It's Murti. Now, what is Murti? Very simple. Murti is anything which takes a form. So Dharma taking a form. So what is the form it takes? Nar Narayan, they give rise to twins. Nar Narayan. So Dharma, when it takes a form, so Nar Narayan are born. So what do they do? And why are they born? So there is a demon by the name of Dambhasura. Very evident. Vanity, ego, personified. So he is, you can't slay him because he has been granted a boon by Sun God himself. That he will hide behind, he has 1,000 armors. Now again, looks very strange. Why would Sun God give such a boon to a demon? But if you understand the mystic experience behind it, so evident. The ego is the first thing which comes to individualize. It cannot, you know, otherwise life cannot continue further. But it cannot bear the law of truth, the light of the sun. So the sun itself gives 1,000 armors, hide behind it, so that directly the power of my light you don't have to bear, but this will protect you, defend you, because there is a need for the ego to continue for some time. So this is the mystic experience behind it. But when Dambasura, naturally when the ego, human beings driven by the ego are going on a rampage, then Murti, Dharma Murti, let's put it together, they aspire. Actually, if you say Ahimsa, it becomes a very interesting story. Because they pray that somebody should kill this, this demon. So this demon is personification of ego. So then Narayan come and they engage in tapasya. So there are many interesting things happen in their life. So one of them is when they are engaged in tapasya, then Indra, after some time, he says, mere mortals, they will grow into gods. So he sends Apsaras. Now, it's very fascinating that why do Apsaras come and what happens to people? So there are two kinds of tapasya people are engaged in. One is very kathor, very, you know, they become very hard, harsh inside. So Indra sends Apsara to sort of make them, that tender feeling should come. Otherwise, you can't go to the divine seat with all this harshness and hardness. So Apsaras are celestial beings. They are not bad beings. They are born of the waters, apas. And they are very nice beings who basically come to soften the heart. And but on these beings, there is no prabhav. So they come and dance and both of them smile and watch. So they just don't know what to do. And among the Apsara, the leading is Menaka. So she is the one who Vishwamitra Rishi succumbs. So then Narayan says, see, I'll tell you one thing. I have a gift. Indra has sent all of you as gifts to me, to us twins. We don't need you, but we have a gift for Indra. So as the story goes, they put a flower on their thigh. And out of the thigh emerges an even more beautiful Urvashi. So Ur is thigh. So from the thigh she emerges and says, please take along. Now this seems like a very strange tale, but it's very meaningful. Where is the thigh? This is thigh, and the belly area is the where the reproductive energies are there. They have not crushed or killed anything. They keep a flower. They have actually transmuted it. They didn't have to crush their tender feelings to, because it's Bhagavat, it's Krishna we are talking about. Not the worship of Shiva. So they have just not only conserved them, they have undergone some kind of transmutation. They are all there. And any time they can emerge, all that love, fondness, affection, beauty, all that is there within them. And they say, take it, because, you know, they have mastered it. They have not crushed it. So that is the kind of tapasya they are engaged in. So naturally they go back and Indra says, enough of it. Then there is another interesting story about Narayan, that they are doing a tapasya in Badrinath. So that's the place where they do tapasya, Badrikashram. And there are two mountains there. You see that they are known as, one is Nar and the other is Narayana. And it is said, this not there in the Bhagavat, at least not that I have read. If I missed, I'll see again. But when the two meet, then the new age will begin. The Satyug will begin. So I still remember going there and looking at how much distance. And you know, this used to be the legend. You know, they are drawing closer and closer. Now nobody really knows. But the story is a symbol. And that's what is the story of Nar and Narayan. So Nar is the one who has to made joined with Narayan. And when Nar and Narayan come together, then the new age will be born. So we'll come still little more time for Nar Narayan full glory. Meanwhile, what about this Asur, Dambasur? He is hiding behind 1,000 kavach armor and he becomes very dangerous. You know, ego is bad enough, but ego which is hiding behind armors. It's, you know, hiding behind armors is constant justification. I am always right. You are the one who is wrong. So whatever I do, there is a justification by the ego. So they are the armors. And he has got a boon. that if he has asked a boon also on top of it. He says, if somebody kills me, he will die. Now you see again, very interesting. Because if you live by the ego self, it's the same story like Oedipus and the Sphinx. If you kill the ego, you die. Because there is no self. That's how it is. So he says, whoever kills me dies. He says, okay. But there is a catch there. Because Krishna has always a trick up his sleeve. Now, what happens is that Nar and Narayan fight him together. They are twins. So when Nar destroys the armor, and each armor destruction means he dies. As soon as he destroys one armor, he dies. But Narayan is meditating that time. He gets up and he revives Nar. Nar goes into tapasya and Narayan fights. So they keep on fighting till they destroy 999 armor. That means there has to be constantly this double poise. You are in action, at the same time you are in a state where you are in eternal union with the Lord. You have joined that. Then only you can conquer it. If you go by inaction, then with the, you know, only in meditation, then with the death of the, either it will fight, you cannot destroy it. Then you come out of it and then there is nothingness. But together they fight. So this continues till there are 999 armors are destroyed. Then the ego, what does it do? All of us, last refuge, mother save me, thodi ijjat bachi reh jaane do, leave a little bit, I am totally naked now, mother. Yeah, this is a mystic experience, very beautiful, very ma, little bit. Don't say that to the divine, because then you will meet the fate of Sahasra Kavach. He goes and takes refuge. So Nar Narayan says, this is the last thing we are going to destroy. So Sun God says, Abhi chod do, leave him. I mean, story is narrated that he says, no, he has taken refuge. It's also true. When you take refuge in the Supreme, you are protected. So he says, see, you can't kill him now because he's under my shelter. So he says, what? He says, well, next life he will be finished. So what happens? Nar Narayan come as Krishna and Arjun. That's how it is declared in the Gita. And who is Sahasra Kavach? With one Kavach left, Karn. So you see, now Karn, if you understand from this background, because he has many good qualities, because many of his armors have gone, and because he has taken refuge in the sun, he has dissolved many of his Dambha. But still there is the last hold of the ego. And then Indra comes and says, Pita, I am showing you the marg of Mukti. See, when you read this story from the mystic sense, they are beautiful. Otherwise, Indra came and he asked that Kavach Kundal and in return gave Amog Shakti. Why did Krishna tell him, you join the, you know, typical mind, you know, why is Krishna telling him that you take the side of Pandavas? Because he wants to save him. Because in the previous life he has been spared. And they are still trying to help him that look here, you can undergo conversion. You don't have to fight this battle. You can undergo conversion without this. You don't need to go through this. Because they know that he has done tapasya and got boons from sun. He is the sun's child now, literally. But he doesn't listen, because that last armor of the ego is when you take pride in good deeds. I am a friend, my promise. What is that sentence in dialogue in Bahubali at the end? He says, Yeh mera vachan hai, mera vachan hi sashan hai. This is my word and my word is the law. He says in good sense. But see, everywhere that last hold of the ego is the ego of righteousness. Karna is unable to do it. Arjun to Shri Krishna demolishes. He says, you don't worry about all this. I'll take it. So when ultimately he is got rid of it, then actually he gets mukti. He is the, that means the ego, you know, it's about the struggle between the ego and the soul. And it can only conquer when the soul is living in the divine. So that's how Sri Aurobindo now talks about Nar Narayana. He talks about the experience several times in Record of Yoga. He talks about the being in the cosmic waters. All these are real experiences. So there is, I'll read something from Sri Aurobindo, that what he speaks about Nar and Narayan. So Nar is the human soul when it is identified with the ego, without Narayana. So it is the male which is identified with the ego. And Narayana has two meanings. The standard meaning is the being in the waters, cosmic waters. So Narayana is the being in the cosmic waters. That's how Lord Vishnu is described. But Sri Aurobindo says, and this is the other meaning which comes from that, he who is the abode of man, Ayana, man, dwelling place of man. The other meaning is that he is the essence of all that man is. So when the divine possibility in man is released by his living constantly in the divine, then whatsoever he does, whether he engages in a fight, in a destructive battle, he is forever free and liberated. So the story of Nar Narayana is so profound. I'll just read what Sri Aurobindo writes in Essays on the Gita, because as we know, the reference comes in the Gita, where Sri Krishna tells him that, Arjun, basically we have been together. So we have been together as Nar and Narayana. You have forgotten it, but I now you see, in a soul which has given itself to God, people often say, what will happen to me? Next life, will I connect or not connect? If you have given yourself to the divine, it is his responsibility. As simple as that. We don't have to worry. And that's what Sri Krishna says also in the Gita. He promises. But here is it. It is in the form of such a beautiful story. So if you have given yourself to the divine, you dwell in the divine, one of the forms of mukti is that, salokya mukti, samipya mukti, then you don't have to worry. Howsoever such a person lives and acts, he acts in the divine. So he says this from Essays on the Gita. Now you see, the beauty of the Bhagavat is that you can form a relation with God. Unlike that traditional Upanishadic understanding. And what is that understanding? That you cannot form a relationship with God. In fact, you have to abandon all relations. Vaishnava tradition has it that you can form a relation with God. But if you go into other forms of pure Vedanta, you cannot form a relation because he is impersonal. He has no personality. He has nothing. All this is illusion. Even the personality is an ultimate illusion which you have to get rid of. So here comes, he says, but here it is, you can form a relation with God. Expresses the relation of God in man to man, in God, in man to man in God. Okay, relation of God in man to man in God. See the difference. God is in everyone. But you have to start dwelling in God. That is the difference. God is in everyone, but automatically it doesn't mean whatever I do, God is there, he'll take care. Oh, you may have a big inheritance, but you have not activated. You have a card, but your papa still holds the, you know, OTP. You can't activate it. So God in man is not enough. To man in God, that is what is the Nar Narayan. By the double figure of Nar Narayana, associated historically with the origin of a religious school, very similar in its doctrines to the teaching of the Gita. Nar is the human soul which, eternal companion of the divine, finds itself only when it awakens to that companionship. So you see, there are two status of the soul. One is when it is identified with the ego, it's fallen. You see all this there in the life divine, the double soul, the divine soul. And there is a status before the fall. And the third is a status where it is, the soul is in union with the divine, but it's not dissolved. So there is a possibility of eternal companionship with the divine. The life and death have no meaning, because you are constantly entering into the cycles to carry the march of civilization forward. And you are always dwelling in God, which is a great joy, greatest of all joys. He says that the secret is, Nar is the human soul which, eternal companion of the divine, finds itself only when it awakens to that companionship and begins, as the Gita would say, to live in God. Sometimes it's so such a good luck when divine snatches away all your companions. But we end up asking, sir, at least koi to de do. Ek, you know, okay, take that armor which you don't want. You will realize one day, then you will come, surrender. Narayan, now this is about Nar. Narayan is the divine soul always present in our humanity. The secret guide, friend and helper of the human being. So always, we are never alone. This whole idea is all, you know, later on you see in certain sects, without a guru and a living guru, you can't. He is always present, and mother says that. She says that developed psychic being becomes the guru because it knows the divine within and it joins with that. She says you don't need anybody outside because that's the real truth. So he says he is the guide, friend and helper of the human being. The Lord who abides within the heart of creatures. So he's everywhere. So lovely. Of the Gita. When within us the veil of that secret sanctuary is withdrawn and man speaks face to face with God, hears the divine voice, receives the divine light, acts in the divine power, then becomes possible the supreme uplifting of the embodied human consciousness into the unborn and eternal. He becomes capable of the dwelling in God and giving up of his whole consciousness into the divine, which the Gita upholds as the best or highest secret of things, uttapam rahasyam. When this eternal divine consciousness, always present in every human being, this God in man, takes possession partly or wholly of the human consciousness and becomes invisible human shape, the guide, teacher, leader of the world, not as those who living in their humanity yet feel something of the love of the divine gnosis, informing and conducting them. See the difference. One is God in man, and man somewhere becomes aware. Other is man in God. This is the great step. When he adopts the human figure, there is a line in Savitri. She takes him then and adopts him as her field. It's like divine adopting. Now you have no other identity. He says, okay, you are no more yourself. Then the human figure becomes a figure of the divine. So, divine gnosis itself, direct from its central force and plenitude, then we have the manifest avatar. The inner divinity is the eternal avatar in man. The human manifestation is its sign and development in the external world. He has given the secret of the Bhagavat actually, because Bhagavat is all about this divine who is hidden in man, taking a human form, and his exploits, his ways and his dealings. So it becomes very tangible, easy to understand. What are his ways? And just one more little thing, then we will stop. We'll talk about all the little bit, touch upon whatever the avatars are there. But one of the avatar which is mentioned in the Bhagavat Puran is the Buddha. And you know what he writes? He says he takes the form of Buddha, and this has been confirmed by Sri Aurobindo in the evening talks. He takes an avatar of Buddha to distract the asuras and take them away from creation. They don't believe in God. So see, Buddhism has an appeal. Buddhism has such a difficulty in taking roots in Indian soil. Because in India, this idea of the divine as being is so prominently rooted. Anatmavad is very difficult. Somewhere intuitively, we have this idea that God dwells within us as a being. So someone, he took this form. One of his avatars is Mohini, to take the, again, distract the asuras, that they are playing a double game. They are wanting the nectar, but they are wanting it for the, you know, their own egoistic satisfactions. So we'll come to some of these avatars as we go through. Dattatreya, many of these. Yajna. So all these are avatars of the Lord Krishna. And each of them basically, if we take it that Sri Krishna is the immanent divine. So what are the forms he has taken through which he has guided the world. Among them, one of them is Krishna, son of Vasudeva. You see, the landscape is very different. It's not the other way around, that this personality, we often think, oh, he is, this personality is a manifestation of that eternal avatar, of whom there are several other avatars. The first avatar and so on and so forth. So we'll touch upon these stories as we'll go every alternate Tuesday, unless there is something else. Jai Maa.